From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour, starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nandi. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a contributing writer for Washington City Paper. Tom Sherwood, welcome.
Good afternoon.
Later in the broadcast, we've got a lot going on today. We'll be talking with Kanik Aguirre, who is an Alexandria City Council member. We will also be talking with Angela Alsobrooks, who is the Prince George's County Executive. And first up, we'll be talking with Katie Crystal, who is a member of the Arlington County Board, who joins us by phone. Katie Crystal, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Amazon announced yesterday that it would not be opening half of its second headquarters in New York as previously planned. What does that mean? What does that imply for Crystal City, where the other half of the headquarters is slated to go?
The short answer is nothing, really. We had an opportunity to confirm with Amazon executives in short order after the announcement was made. We have confirmed that we are moving forward exactly as planned with their intended headquarters in Arlington. Our current schedule to consider the performance agreement in March hasn't changed. The terms of that performance agreement, 25,000 jobs and 4 million square feet of office space, haven't changed either. So definitely lots of headlines, lots of news, but in terms of the impacts for what we're planning here in Crystal City and Pentagon City and Arlington County, no changes at this time.
You know, everyone wants the government to move quickly. It makes sense that Amazon and the county and the state of Virginia, the Commonwealth of Virginia, would say nothing has changed. Our agreements are in place. But in the weeks and the
Meanwhile,
months that go ahead.
Meanwhile, that swishing sound you hear in the background is them rubbing their hands in glee.
Yes, Montgomery County has indicated it will try again to get Amazon's attention. But it just makes practical sense that you go forward with what you've signed and agreed to now and what you're agreeing to. But this does have perhaps an opportunity in the future.
I think that there are probably a lot of communities that are seeing that way, exactly as you just noted, either in our region or even, we've seen some news coverage suggesting as much nationally. What we've heard from Amazon at this time is that they're not planning to reopen the search. They have something like 17 different offices. I believe they call them tech hubs around the country. And they're planning to sort of see organic growth across those 17 different sites at this point. Obviously, I can't speak for them and how their plans might change. Anticipate with any major corporate tenant in Arlington County that there might be natural plans for growth over time. I'm not going to rule out what might happen 5, 10, 15 years down the road into the future. But for now, what we want to be clear about with interested Arlingtonians who may have already had some concerns about how we might be absorbing 25,000 employees, that is still very much the plan.
Is there any danger that Amazon could run into a brick wall in Virginia, like it did in New York, where the governor and the mayor of New York wholeheartedly endorsed Amazon, but members of Congress and local legislators
and
rose
activists
up against it? Do you see anything like that on the horizon at all in Virginia?
I think it's salient that the terms of the deal with the state have already passed the General Assembly, right? We had a different mechanism at the state level than I think New York did. And as far as what we've seen in Arlington, I think the most important thing is to just note that the terms of the deal were pretty different with that New York location than they are here in Arlington County. We've been pretty parsimonious, I think, in terms of the incentives offered, for example. And I think that was really, I'm no expert in New York City politics, but I think
no one is.
I know, maybe not even New York politicians, right? But I think that seems to be a big part of what was motivating a lot of the pushback, was just the size of the incentives and whether the people in that community would be benefiting as well as Amazon would be benefiting. And I believe that we really can make the case that the people of Arlington County stand to benefit from this location decision here in Arlington.
Katie Crystal is a member of the Arlington County Board. Katie Crystal, thank you so much for joining us. Stay tuned on Monday because we'll be talking with residents of Arlington County, some of whom still have some concerns about the Amazon second headquarters being located there. But thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks again.
Tom Sherwood joining us in studio now is Angela Alsobrooks. She's the Prince George's County Executive. Angela Alsobrooks, thank you so much for joining
us. Thank you. Good afternoon.
In the meantime, Tom Sherwood, Angela Alsobrooks was in town for the inauguration of our mayor, Muriel Bowser, but the Washington Post, the Washington City Paper reports that the Bowser Inaugural Committee took in nearly $1 million and that a lot of that money came from lobbyists, developers, people who have contracts with the district government and people seeking contracts. There was a lot of brouhaha about that, and since then the city council has taken action. They hate to be called a city council.
It is not a city council. It has city, county, and state affairs. It'd be like calling you some kind of CB radio host.
It's not them who hate us. It's he who hates
it. Yes. Wow. Well, the mayor has made a huge money grab here. She was easily reelected. The law in 2020 changes, and if you give money for an inauguration, the maximum now is 10. It's going down to 4. So the mayor put out the word, apparently, we want money, and she has raised all this money. Much of it came after the inauguration was over, not just to pay some outstanding bills, but to provide a mailer that went out to a lot of people in town. She took $150,000 left over in her campaign account and put that money in our inauguration account, which is fine. But the problem, people say, this reminds too many people of Fresh Pack. Back in 2015, when she was first elected mayor, she created a political action committee because there was a loophole in the law that during non-campaign years, you could raise unregulated amounts of money, unrestricted amounts of money. And even the Washington Post editorial page, which likes virtually everything she does, lobbied against it. So I'd like to say I had a little bit to do with the Mitch Riles, he's the new Loose Lips City Paper, and putting that story together. But he worked on it very hard to show there's just a lot of money there, and the mayor hasn't really explained why she's raised so much money after the inauguration.
Our guest is Angela Alsobrooks. She's the Prince George's County Executive.
I have a campaign finance question that segues perfectly into our guest.
So you say.
There is a legislation, Delegate Davis has legislation pending from the Prince George's delegation in Annapolis that would take away the ethics restrictions on accepting campaign contributions from corporations. And you have not taken a public position on that. Many people believe that Rashern Baker's campaign for governor was severely restricted because he could not take corporate contributions, and he was outspent by Ben Jealous terribly, even though he was leading in some of the polls. Where are you, Ms. Alsobrooks, as the county executive, on getting rid of the restriction on corporate donations to campaigns, and perhaps your campaign for governor or attorney general, should that happen in a couple of years? Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you so much. Glad to be here. So we have not taken a position. We haven't. This was a bill that the delegate put in without conferring with us about it. Prince George's County is uniquely situated. The rules and restrictions that we have in Prince George's County do not exist anyplace else in the state. We have taken very aggressive stances there, ethics reforms. The council also recently passed campaign finance legislation as well. And we were not a part of that, but we agree with that legislation to provide funding for candidates who are running for office. And so these are areas that we believe are best, of course, handled by the legislators, both the campaign finance and the bill that the delegate put in. And we will abide by whatever the decision is.
If the law is changed, and this all, as we know, all came about because of the corruption of Jack Johnson. The Sharon Baker helped him put these laws in place with the council because of all the corruption in the county, as you and he cleaned up the county on so many different levels. But you're not philosophically opposed to taking corporate contributions if they are legal contributions.
All right. You know, we will follow whatever the campaign finance laws are. We've been careful to do that. We will continue to be careful to follow whatever the campaign finance laws are, whatever the restrictions are. And we are most focused on governing at this point. So whatever the laws are, we will follow them.
Earlier this week, Governor Larry Hogan announced that he is ending his efforts to persuade the Washington Redskins to stay in Prince George's County. What does that mean for the possibility of the team staying in Prince George's after its current lease at FedEx Field expires in 8 years.
So it doesn't change our positioning at this point. You know, we believe that the Washington Redskins' presence in Prince George's County is a great amenity. Our citizens have enjoyed it. I am a Redskins fan. The governor is a Redskins fan. And so it's an amenity that our community has enjoyed. And so we would love to have the Redskins stay in Prince George's. What we have said, however, and I had an opportunity to meet with the governor yesterday, is that we have some priorities in Prince George's County that are very clear for us, that we are focused laser-like on investments in education and investments in our inner beltway areas, eliminating food deserts. And so we have a long list of priorities, transportation and infrastructure projects. Would we love to have the Redskins stay? Yes, we believe that we are an ideal location for them. But we're also staying focused on the priorities that we've set for ourselves.
Governor Hogan said that he's still seeking to get state control over the Oxen Cove Park site adjacent to National Harbor, which had been tapped as a site for the new football stadium from the federal government, which currently is in possession of it. What would you like to see happen at Oxen Cove?
Well, what we'd have to do is, first of all, to have a transparent process that includes public input. That is not a decision that I think should be made in a vacuum. It is one, I think, that requires, first of all, lots of transparency, but also it requires public input. So we would be interested in not only studying it, that would require lots of studies to determine the best use of that property, but we would not make a single decision without the appropriate input from the communities that are impacted.
Well, I'm not sure I understand James's email, but you might better than I do. He says on Oxon Hill National Park waterfront land and Teton National Park, Hogan land trade. Governor Hogan told the Washington Post that he negotiated his land trade memo of understanding with Secretary Ryan Zinke. Zinke has been fired as Secretary of the Interior by Trump. Park Service cannot accept Antietam land without an act of Congress. Why does the governor think he has a deal?
I don't know. He'd have to ask the governor about it.
And let's be clear, the governor's statement, a lot of the media reports left the impression with headlines and first paragraphs that the Governor Hogan had abandoned his plan to swap Oxen Cove land with land in Western Maryland. He has not abandoned it. His own statement said that, quote, at this time, he is not doing anything. He still is going forward with this land swap because there is a feeling, and the county executive maybe could respond to this, is that that land, while everyone loves natural parkland and all of that, with MGM, with a casino there, and National Harbor, a new football stadium or some major development in that area, respectful of the land, would bring more economic development to the county. So it's not... A lot of people don't think it should be kept wilderness. Others do, and that's part of the political battle. But the governor at this time has pulled back his proposal, and I think he's doing that, according to the people I've talked to, until he can get a better understanding if this land swap will go forward. Have you talked to, like, Dan Snyder or the owner, the beloved owner of the Redskins?
No.
I say that facetiously because it seems everyone I talk to hates him.
I have not talked to the owner regarding this. I met the owner just at a Redskins game out. But I have not talked to Dan Snyder about it. I have had an opportunity, as I mentioned, as of yesterday, to talk to the governor about this. And again, we agree that Prince George's County is a great location for the Redskins. Where we'd have to talk about that. But we'd love to keep the Redskins, but we will not do anything that is not in the best interest of Prince Georgians, and we'll make a decision based on that.
The Supreme Court decision last year that legalized sports gambling has pushed jurisdictions to start their own legal sports gambling systems. D.C. is in the midst of developing its own. And one argument that people on the D.C. Council have made for fast-tracking the process is that they want to get out ahead of Maryland and Virginia and be the first to launch. How do you think this will affect National Harbor? How do you think it will keep National Harbor as an attractive and competitive destination in light of this new gambling landscape?
Oh, yeah. MGM is a beautiful site that's hard to rival. It really is. It stands out in the state and across the country. It's a beautiful site. As I understand it, sports betting is moving through the legislature in Maryland. The expectation from those I've spoken with is that it will pass in Maryland. And so I believe that MGM will remain not only an attractive site, but one that is also very, very profitable. If I'm honest about it, it has been a real asset and revenue-wise in Prince George's County and throughout the state, because the dollars that are generated at MGM go into the lockbox for education. And because of the success of that particular casino and the others, we've had a good deal of dollars that are now available for education. And so we expect it to continue continue to be
in
profitable.
Other words, bring it on, D.C.
Bring it on.
Do you think there ought to be a state referendum to allow sports betting? Or do you think if the legislature and the governor signs it?
I think if the legislature and the governor sign it, then it'll go forward.
But we should point out that the District of Columbia the council has passed one version of starting sports betting. It now it looks like it will be on the agenda for February the 19th. So the district is moving a lot faster than Virginia and Maryland.
Speaking of sports, you're pushing statewide legislation that would place youth sports under the responsibility of a single public agency, the Maryland National Capital Park and Planning Commission. Why, and what are some of the challenges that youth athletes in the county are facing?
So we're so excited about this. And by the way, youth sports is not necessarily about developing athletes. It's about developing strong children. So as a part of our education agenda, we have decided that investing in youth sports allows us to develop children with strong character, who are not only emotionally strong, but also physically. We are concerned about the physical health of our children. And so making youth sports more accessible to more children says to us that we build a whole child, a child who learns perseverance and a team, how to work with a team, learns how to concentrate. So that's what youth sports is about. Maryland National Capital Park and Planning does it well, but we believe that we can do even better.
What's wrong now?
Well, what we find now is that some of the centers, we have 84 of them in the county, that we have not worked as well as we could with the school system to coordinate the use of those facilities, that sometimes we have whole sports teams that find it difficult, quite honestly, to get time to practice at those facilities. We want to make sure that the process is seamless so that our kids are not locked out of any facility in Prince George's County. We have a beautiful sports team. We have track teams. And what we've heard from parents, and I met with those parents recently, is that there is great frustration over the fact that too many of our centers, the Boys and Girls Clubs, are dying on the vine as they try to find a way to operate.
Some high school facilities are not available to them.
Exactly. So we want to make sure that we are coordinated in a way that benefits children. And we believe the long-term impact, if we invest not only in the classroom, but invest in our kids outside the classroom, we're going to continue to build strong kids, strong students, strong citizens. And this is what
there's more effort to try to find a field or a playing gym or something like that than there is actually doing it. So I have a quick round robin.
If I can just say, Tom, and that's disgraceful. If you want to know what I'm really trying to get at, there should be no facility in Prince George's County with tax dollars that's not available to a child who desires to play a sport in Prince George's County. We should not have to go to Potomac, Maryland, like I did with my daughter who played PG cross with a PG Pride, and her lacrosse games were in Potomac. Our kids need to play on fields that are befitting of them in Prince George's.
Okay, politics. Hogan for president. Where do you stand?
I'm a Democrat, but, I'm a Democrat, but I have to be honest with you. I think better than the guy who's in the White House right now is my thought on that.
Okay.
For sure, Hogan's would be much better than the guy there.
See, that was an easy question. There's a nice news service in Prince George's Route 1 news service that Mitch Thies, I think, does. He reported this week online that there is a poll going on in the county asking extensive questions about one Angela Alsobrooks. Detailed, lengthy polling. And he says that he tried to contact your office to find out if that is your poll or if it's not your poll. Can you tell us if that poll, which asks extensive questions about policy issues in Prince George's County and Angela Alsobrooks, is that your political committee's poll?
It is. And our political committee
Mitch,
is interested. Thank you so much. In our political committee, it is not a government poll.
No, it's private.
What we're concerned about is making sure that we are not only communicating with our citizens in the best way that's possible, but we also want to know what they care about. As we make policy decisions and move forward in areas, we want to make sure that we are in line with what citizens care about. And so it helps us as not only as we communicate, but as we form policy to make sure that we're not only meeting with our citizens, which we have done through community conversations and regular meetings, but we also take the opportunity to use the other tools that we have to make sure that we're hearing from citizens.
I haven't heard any criticism of the poll. In fact, people think it's a really good poll and it's giving you important information. One of the questions is, I ask you this every time you come, one of the polling questions is, should you legalize marijuana? Can you tell us what the results are, or are you still getting the results?
You know what? I think the results are in line with what I think. And let me just tell you what I think. I think that what adults choose to do in their time, be it smoke it, sprinkle it on cereal, do whatever it is they do, is their business. I am concerned about kids and the impact, the developmental impact, the ability to get a job. Those are the things. And so I think most people believe that adults and what they do with marijuana is the business of that adult, that they don't want any, they don't want us to regulate that portion of it. But I think most people are concerned about the impact on youth and that we communicate clearly with them the developmental impacts and how it affects their ability to get a job. You can't test positive for marijuana in Prince George's and get a job.
May I ask one more political question? And this one is kind of party painful. Your career has been a fight against domestic abuse, having women be respected when they are attacked, that any person attacked, not just women. I believe you are personal friends with Justin Fairfax, the Lieutenant Governor of Virginia. You have looked across the boundaries. You have seen what he's going through now. Have you said anything publicly, or have you wanted to say anything publicly about what he's facing? You can comment on the governor and the attorney general's blackface issues, but I know you both went to Duke with Justin Fairfax, and that he showed up at your events. I think you've been to his. Where's your feeling about what's happening with the lieutenant governor in Virginia, given your personal relationship with him and the politics of what he's dealing with, plus the women who are making these allegations?
So to be honest with you, nobody's inquired about what I thought about what was happening in Virginia. So the question hasn't been asked me. But I can tell you this, that sexual assault is a very serious crime. The allegation is a very serious one. And I agree with everyone, including Justin, who says that it ought to be investigated and that there ought to be a thorough investigation conducted to be able to not only hear from and respect the victims in this case, but to make sure that justice is served in whatever that is. And so I believe that it ought
to be everyone involved, including him.
Including him. I believe in the justice system. I also believe that victims ought to be respected and heard from. And I believe that that's what ought to happen in this case.
Have you talked to him at all since this all happened?
No, I've not.
I know you've both been very busy, but it's
no, I've not. Had a chance to talk to him.
12 Prince George's County police officers are suing the department over allegations that officers of color are denied promotions and are retaliated against for reporting misconduct involving white officers. Your office told us that you cannot comment on the case directly as it's still pending, but this is not the first time the department has faced such allegations. What do you think the department is getting right, and what do you think it's getting wrong when it comes to race and racism?
Well, you know, that's what we have an opportunity to find out. As you're right that this is now a legal matter. I believe that it will be resolved, and I think it should be resolved in the courthouse and not in the court of public opinion. I want to know the truth about it. And what I know is that when the case is resolved, if we find, for example, that there is a pattern of discrimination, if that's what the lawsuit reveals, then we will take action and we will correct whatever they find. If they find something different than that, we'll use that. But I believe that it ought to be resolved in the court. But I also know that right now we are conducting reviews of all of our agencies, including the police department. That is the police department, Department of Public Works and Transportation. And we are looking at the culture throughout government to discover what that culture is. And we will be making adjustments throughout government to improve what we do. And that includes whatever we find with respect to race relations. I have not worked in the police department, as you know. And so I'm not intimately aware, but I'm interested in knowing. And if we find that there is something that ought to be corrected, we will correct it.
This is a systematic review of the county. Is that something you've been announced? Does it have a name, or is it a program that you have? Have you called it something that people?
No, you know what I've talked about, and it's not just inside government; it's outside. I believe that we ought to address making sure that the culture is one that has high standards, accountability, transparency, and performance. And I have made that clear to every single director that I have hired, and the ones that we have retained, is that we're looking in those agencies to make sure that they are operating in an optimal way that best benefits our citizens. And we're finding that there are adjustments that can be made, and I think this is good news.
So you have like 1,500 sworn officers in Prince George's County. I think there's something like 300 people who are civilian support staff.
Yeah,
the ACLU has cited or has helped these 12 officers. While you can't comment on the case itself, is there any concern at all that the ACLU thought it was serious enough to be involved?
It is, but you know what? You just made the optimal point. 1,500 sworn officers, they said that we're talking about 12. I think it is so important not to overlook the fact that we have 1,482 by that. I'm sorry, it's something more than that. It's probably 88. 1,488 who have not been a part of this and who do an exceptional job. Find a jurisdiction where you cut crime by 50% in 8 years, and you'll find it is an amazing department. Now, again, if we find, and I am totally, I am whatever we find, we will be honest about it and address it. But I think it is so important and fair to the 1,488 who are working so hard and are performing an excellent service for our community that they agree is an excellent service, not to lose sight of that as well.
I think a lot of people have lost a couple of decades ago, particularly 50s, 60s, 70s. The Prince George's Police reputation was horrific.
Back in those days, and there were civil rights actions that were taken.
It was, and thanks to the consent decree that happened in the late 90s, we've had an opportunity to correct a lot of those things, and we're going to keep working until we get it right.
But the problem they're having right now, Tom Sherwood, people who are stealing handicapped parking placards. Last week, Prince George's County Police Chief Hank Stawinski announced that his department would crack down on such thefts. How widespread of a problem is that?
Well, you know, what the chief tells me is that in the last 6 months, we've had at least one placard per day that's been stolen. These are being sold for $100 on the street. This is what the chief calls tomfoolery. I think I agree with it as well. It's
that's
just a silly crime. It is a silly crime. We're cracking down on it because we believe that all crimes are important. And this is the kind of thing that leads to more. But theft is important to us. But it's a really ridiculous crime that we've seen one per day.
And the people who are differently abled, it's not only that people would steal these placards, which are vital to the person using it, but the District of Columbia has a problem in that people have fake ones, that they maybe get a doctor who's not in the district to sign a form. So it's a real issue that people who do get legitimate placards ought not to be deprived of them by either theft or people who have fake ones.
Almost out of time. Earlier this week, we discussed legislation in Maryland that, if passed, would give Prince George's County more say in the expansion of the Capitol Beltway. What do you think about that? And more generally, what do you think of Governor Hogan's plans for expanding the Beltway, adding four toll lanes?
So we're looking forward to having a briefing on that. I have not been briefed on it. The governor's transportation secretary and cabinet members are coming to give us a briefing on it so that we will have more information and so we can have a more informed position. We have not taken a position on it because I've not been able to hear the details of that plan, and we'll be glad to take a position on it when we have more information.
But you generally think local jurisdictions should have veto authority over the state? It is the way it is in other parts of the state.
Eight counties have veto authority over the state's plans to run highways in their counties. Is that something you would want for Prince George's County?
And again, you know what? When we have more information about what the plan is, I'll be able to have a different opinion about it. But you're saying 8 out of 24 jurisdictions mm-hmm. have that ability now.
Most of them on the Eastern Shore.
So.
And of course, this is Governor Hogan's plan. Your predecessor wanted to run for governor against Larry Hogan. He didn't make it past the primary. But what is the nature of your relationship with the governor?
Well, we're developing a working relationship, and the governor is a native Prince Georgian, so we're glad about that. I'm looking forward to working with him, and to be honest with you, with all of our electeds, federal electeds, the state, we need all of those partnerships and relationships to make sure that Prince George's agenda is fulfilled. And so I did not have a previous relationship, but I am really glad to build a relationship with the state, with the governor, with his cabinet, as well, again, as with our federal officials to make sure that we are really making sure that huge accomplishments occur in Prince George's County. We want success to happen in Prince George's.
And when next time you speak with the governor, would you please tell him his invitation to appear on the Politics Hour remains open, or any day of the week, for Coach Oba, Monday through Friday.
Right.
He has never been here.
He's never,
never been.
Well, I have been
broadcast.
Here. I enjoy coming. I'm glad to be invited and enjoy always having the opportunity to talk to your listeners.
Pass that on to him. Angela Also Brooks is the Prince George's County Executive. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Up next, Kanik Aguirre. He's an Alexandria City Council member. If you have questions for him, start calling now, 800-433-8850. Tom Sherwood, the federal court has approved the Virginia redistricting plan, a plan that would put 6 Republicans into districts that would probably become majority Democratic. And one of those Republicans is the House Speaker, Kirk Cox. Now, the House Speaker has appealed the redistricting to the Supreme Court, but the 3-judge panel said that the proposal The plan approved by University of California Irvine professor Bernard Groffman should go ahead. My question to you is that is it likely to go ahead before November elections in the Commonwealth of Virginia, or is the Supreme Court likely to act before then?
I think the court would act quickly if it's going to act. The question is whether it would even take this up. The district court has dealt with this for some time. It's had the independent person from California to look at it. It has resisted suggestions that there's anything political about it. So I think probably it will go forward. And that it is interesting that the Speaker of the House, a Republican, would be one of the people who would see his district. Most of these districts are in the middle of the state, would be significantly changed. We just have to remember that the House is a Republican, only 51-48. And the Senate is 21-19. So these six districts suddenly become Democratic and nothing else changes, the Democrats would take control of the House and the Senate this fall. But, of course, they have these ongoing issues with the governor, the lieutenant governor and attorney general, which has a big question mark over how Democrats will do this fall.
And bucking a trend in which the majority of states have repealed or reformed their mandatory minimum laws, the legislature in Virginia seems to be going in the opposite direction, asking for mandatory minimums of life in prison for 15 crimes. And there are those who say that these are very serious crimes and therefore they deserve life in prison, but others who say you're taking away discretion from judges. Why have judges if you're going to just pass mandatory?
Well, I think unfortunately, I think we might be going back through these types of crimes, issues ebb and flow, and we might be heading towards a tougher approach to crime. The president today talked about how China takes care of its drug problem by killing the drug dealers. In the district, the mayor has agreed to let the U.S. attorney prosecute some crimes, gun crimes and murders, that would move those crimes outside of a more lenient D.C. rehabilitation law. And so I think what you're seeing is a lot of places people are objecting and reacting to homicides.
Kanik Aguirre joins us in studio. He's an Alexandria City Council member. Kanik Aguirre, thank you for joining us.
Good to be back.
Is this trend that was just voted into the Virginia legislature of more mandatory minimums of crimes one that you approve of?
You know, I think we really have to take a look at it again, because I feel we're going the right direction. We were looking at restoration rights across the state and really trying to improve outcomes for minority communities across the state. So I think we need to re-engage in discussions around this.
It's some of the and I'm not going to read all 15, but one of them is if you're over 18, if you kill a police officer, I think, or any other public safety person, there would be life without parole. If you were to kill a pregnant woman in an attempt to kill the fetus, if you kill a child under 14, although I don't see how you sit in a legislature and say, okay, a child under 14 is mandatory life in prison, but if you kill someone who's 15, I thought that was an odd part of the law. So you want to look at more of these.
Yeah, I think there should be a little bit more discussion around
it. And murder for hire. Maybe life in prison for murder for hire, I might agree with.
You were raised in Los Angeles, went to school at the University of North Carolina, but have been active for quite a long time in Alexandria. What brought you to this region?
Well, they say Virginia's for lovers, and I'm no exception. I basically followed my fiance, girlfriend at the time. I followed her up here. Her prospects in terms of employment were a little bit better than mine, so I said, let's go try our luck up in Northern Virginia.
Now, you seem to have done pretty well with your own prospects of employment since you have been here.
Right after the primary, right? You won.
Yes.
Fourth out of six, or fifth out of...
Fourth.
Fourth.
I don't know. Yeah, fourth.
I think you were fourth.
Yeah. But the city of Alexandria has been really good to me, so they invested in me, and I'm investing back in the city.
Go ahead, Tom.
But this is a silly question, but I was watching the video of the inauguration on January the 3rd, and please don't email me or text me or Twitter me, folks. But I thought that was one of the longest series of bagpipes when you guys marched into the auditorium. They played, and everybody went up on the stage. And I like bagpipes, like the blue, service in downtown for police officers.
But...
But Have you ever had been exposed to that much bagpiping in your life?
Not since he lived in Scotland.
Right, exactly, yeah. We have a rich history in Alexandria, and the bagpipes are definitely a big part of that.
So tri-cornered hat and bagpipes. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's it. Go ahead, Coach.
Last month, Greater Washington reported that between the years 2000 and 2017, Alexandria lost 90% of its affordable housing. What do you think accounts for that drop?
So some of it is that some of our market affordable housing was going out of stock, right? So they had agreements up to a certain amount of time that they were going to be affordable, but they've reached the limits for that. A really nice thing that we did, we try to get ahead of this. We had a Route 1 South affordability. I think it's now known as the South Patrick Henry affordability plan that we're looking at, and we're trying to get ahead of some of these things to say, okay, well, we know something like this is about to happen. How can we try and preserve affordable housing within that area? And we did a great amount of community outreach, but, you know, we also have to be looking at our zoning ordinances and what we're doing to try and protect some of our housing in the areas that we have. And, of course, you know, the elephant in the room is Amazon and the impact that that's going to have as well.
Some are pushing for increased density in new housing development. How much of a dent would that make in addressing the affordable housing crisis?
I think density is going to be an important aspect that we have to look at because we have opportunities around some of our metro stations to try and increase density. And it seems counterintuitive to a lot of people, but by increasing density around some of our transit hubs, we'll actually alleviate some of the traffic and create more housing opportunities overall.
Let's talk Amazon. Many people in the region see the Amazon second headquarters coming to Crystal City just north of Alexandria as a potential threat to the building and to the preservation of affordable housing. Do you share that view? And if so, what do you think can be done to counteract it?
No, yeah, absolutely. I think a lot of people are saying, oh, well, it's going to be very minor. It's a $25 increase in rents or prices, and it's a small blip in the statistics. But we have to realize that small blip in the statistics and that $25 increase, those are people's lives. We're talking about, you know, first-year police officers, first-year teachers, service industry workers, restaurant workers, and we have to make sure that we're creating housing opportunities, like I said, for everyone. So we have to make sure that we're paying very close attention and mitigating the impact that's coming from Amazon. Well, you know, it's no secret I was the board president of Tenants and Workers United, which is a leading group, a leading voice representing the community, because the Arlanjia Chirilawa neighborhood will be one of the most impacted in the region because of its proximity to where the headquarters will be going in. So we have to make sure that we're not only preserving our diversity, but also the opportunity for our families to gain access.
How do you do that? What's the plan?
You know, it's having conversations with the community. It's looking at our zoning ordinances. It's trying to put in protections around looking at, you know, what historical aspect do we have within the Arlanjia Chirilawa neighborhood.
Well, what can you put a little more on what I call the meat on the bones on this? Minneapolis faces a horrid. Everyone likes to. The good news is jurisdictions like Alexandria are having to manage increasing prosperity. That mm-hmm. is, things are. And the mayor, Justin Wilson, said we have to manage redevelopment. Otherwise, the homeowners will get more and more taxes on them if we don't have reasonable development. Minneapolis got rid of single-family zoning and said any residential property can have up to 3 housing units on that property. There'll be no more single-family development. I don't think Alexandria is going to do that. But is there anything specific you would do that Kojo was asking, anything specific you would do to change zoning? Or are you just now starting to look at it and it might be years before you change it?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely conversations around accessory dwellings that we're having right now to see where we could try and do some add-ins, especially in the Delray and Potomac area. But, you know, we might eventually have to come to this conversation. Minneapolis is really kind of the avant-garde with what's going on right now.
Well, how long will these, quote, conversations, unquote, continue? Because accessory dwellings, the district changed its zoning laws, and if you have a garage in the back, you can turn it into an accessory dwelling. Mm-hmm. But is this a conversation that people will have into next year? Because it's only a 2-year term, right?
3-year.
3-year term, mm-hmm. Okay. Another odd thing about Virginia, 3-year terms. But conversations can only go on so long. One of the criticisms of the previous mayor, Silverberg, was that she would talk too much about issues rather than taking action. When can the people of Alexandria expect this largely new council and new mayor to take action?
Well, I think that's part of it, right? Having such a new council, we're all still kind of getting settling into our roles, right? But I think that because we have such a new council, we're going to be able to move forward with some changes. So it's conversations with my colleagues as well to see, try and create a timeline around this. When do we want to see this happen?
Are we talking 2019, 2020?
I'm saying within our first cycle, within our first term. So within our first 3 years, I think we definitely have to get some motion going.
You serve on the Northern Virginia Transportation Commission and on the Council of Governments Transportation Planning Board. There's currently debate over the rail service hours for Metro, with officials here in D.C. looking to extend them and officials in Maryland and Virginia trying to keep the current hours in place. And yesterday, there was a vote to keep the current hours in place. What do you think about the current hours for Metro Rail Service? The D.C. officials
folded,
including Jack Evans, who's chair of the board, as Tom said, folded. But they're saying, look, we're losing business here in the District of Columbia. And a lot of our employees who would be working in those businesses can't get home from work late at night.
See, I think it's also a balance, too, because we have to think about the public safety issue around this as well. I stand with the letter that we sent from the Northern Virginia Transportation Commission in that the maintenance improvements and the reliability improvements that we've made because of the reduced hours are extremely important. Now, I think once we get a little further along in our maintenance and reliability issues, then we could reconvene around that discussion to look at the hours again. But at this time, I think we have to maintain the maintenance schedule that we're on to make sure we're making the proper improvements, because in Alexandria, we're about to lose all of our metro stations south of the airport.
I was going to say, this summer program Metro is doing is looking at it this morning on the website, something like 20 stations are affected. Are you confident, although you're new into your job, that alternative transportation from vans or bus service or clearing express lanes, is there anything that you, or do you think that Alexandria is ready for all these shutdowns that's going to severely affect Metro ridership?
Yeah, this is a huge deal. You know, it's totally unprecedented. I like what I've been seeing. There's still more to be done. We have a couple other options that we're exploring right now, potentially using Landmark as a hub to put folks on shuttles to get them in to D.C. and to other areas. So we have a plan in place right now, but there's still some tweaks and some improvements that need to be made, and it's going to be extremely important to make sure that we get the word out to everyone.
Is there any thought that Metro... Everyone wants Metro to be repaired, but is there any thought that Metro plan is just has too much of a negative impact on Alexandria, that it ought to be lengthened or changed in some way?
What do you mean lengthened?
Well, just do some of this work later. Spread it out so that the whole system is not shut down.
Well, I mean, part of it is we don't want to just keep on kicking the can down the road, right? So some of it, we just have to get this done.
I just remember when Adam Tuss at Channel 4 several years ago reported that Metro was going to close down the Red Line from Rockville to Chevy to D.C. People had heart attacks, and of course it didn't happen. Mm.
Well, traffic deaths, speaking of heart attacks, traffic deaths and especially pedestrian deaths are up across the region despite jurisdictions like yours taking on this Vision Zero initiatives for pedestrian safety. What's Alexandria getting right about pedestrian safety, and where can it improve?
You know, unfortunately, we actually just had a traffic death not too long ago. It was a couple of weeks ago, I believe, up on Beauregard. But we have to be looking at our overall infrastructure, right? We have to be looking at, are we creating safe walkways? Are we creating safe bikeways? Are we improving pedestrian safety at intersections so that it's more visible for drivers?
Are you?
Yes, we're in the process of doing that now. We've actually just started putting no turn on red restrictions on certain intersections where we know there's going to be issues. We're looking at other intersections where we create more visibility for pedestrians, little bulbs that come out.
Is that part of the Vision Zero? Does Alexandria have a Vision Zero program?
Absolutely.
That's exactly
Absolutely.
The types of things that the city of Washington is doing, other jurisdictions are doing. The general complaint, you might agree with it, is that they're not being done fast enough. Montgomery County, or I think Montgomery County has a whole bicycle plan, and the D.C. has one, Alexandria.
We're actually updating our mobility master plan currently, so we're definitely looking at all of that.
You're looking at a lot of things and having a lot of conversations. When are you going to have legislation and bills? That's what that's what people want to hear. Let me ask you another
action,
issue.
Absolutely.
You've got the school issue in terms of crowding in Alexandria schools. both Maryland and Virginia legislatures are looking at allowing schools to open before Labor Day. Do you have a view on that and what that would mean?
So I believe our school system is in favor of that. We have slightly different situations that we're dealing with in terms of our student population. We need to be able to lessen the summer loss in learning and also try and get some of our English language learners a few more resources as well. So I think it's important, at least to us as a locality, because other jurisdictions might not need this, but at least in Alexandria, I think it's going to be important. I think our school board and our superintendent will be behind that as well.
Given the Dillon rule, which limits mm-hmm. what you can do without the state's approval, can you go to year-round schooling where you have four quarters of school during the year and there's just small breaks between the quarters as opposed to the agricultural system of shutting down for the summer?
The legislation is still there, and they haven't voted on it yet, so won't know till then.
Last year, the city permanently took over the former munitions factory turned art space, the Torpedo Factory, and there's been some questions raised in light of the Torpedo Factory takeover around the language of quote-unquote vibrancy. The editorial board of the Alexandria Times wrote, quoting here, "At what point on the graph do we move from the positivity of vibrancy to the negative of eroding livability?" They also raised the concern that the city is pursuing development to compete with National Harbor and the Wharf without properly considering the things about Alexandria that make your city unique. What do you think about that, and is there a tension between vibrancy and livability?
There's only a certain number of scented candles that you can sell at the Torpedo Factory.
So first of all, we're in 2019, we're going to be at the 100-year anniversary of the Torpedo Factory, and the 45th year anniversary for the artists being in that space. Number one, I'm a huge supporter of the arts. You know, we're starting an art district just north of the Torpedo Factory as well. And the Torpedo Factory has a long history, so I'm a little bit more new to Virginia and to Alexandria, but at the same time, we have to strike this balance because we still have to be competitive in the region. We're still vying for visitors and for tourist dollars. So I think we have to make sure that all stakeholders are at the table and that all voices are being listened to when we're having this difficult conversation about balancing vibrancy versus
arts. There's that word
arts.
Conversation again. I'm going to start monitoring your word of the conversation.
Next time you're going to have to get the clicker and see how many times
clicker,
I say it.
You're going to hear the click and
But what do you think the city's role in general should be in promoting arts and culture in Alexandria?
I think we need to take an active role. Personally, you know, I was just at John Adams Elementary School a few weeks ago, and we have a great collaboration between our Alexandria Symphonic Orchestra, which is a real gem in the city. If people don't realize it's there, definitely go check it out. But they were working with the elementary students at John Adams, and they created original music. And they had a little concert going, Concerto Simpatico, I think they called it. It was really great. When I was at the ribbon cutting for Patrick Henry, we had a great dance presentation. I was able to tour the Black Box that they have, Black Box Stage, that they're opening within the school. So, you know, we have opportunities not just within our school system, but also out in the community to do artwork. I remember the power boxes, you know, those green or black or gray, they look really dull. We had an artist go out and paint all of them. You know, and so it's really great. Little things like that make a big difference.
The museum is looking for a home. You know, it's having, because of cost, giving up its space on Pennsylvania Avenue. It says it wants to stay in the region, have maybe a smaller project. But given Alexandria's history and early colonial days, news reporting and the vibrancy of Amazon coming in now, maybe there's a spot in Alexandria for a reduced but still relevant museum.
There might be.
It used to be in Roslyn.
It was in Roslyn, that little circular spectrum or whatever it's called now.
Before it came here.
Right.
So who knows? Kanek Aguirre is an Alexandria City Council member. Thank you so much for joining.
Thanks again, Coach and Tom.
We're out of time already. I was going to ask him if he's still a University of North Carolina fan, because I'm a Duke fan. They're playing next Wednesday.
Oh, heels all day.
And Duke is not, as you know, well-liked in this region.
That's the only reason I like them. I only like them because there's so much hate going against Duke. I got to be for them.
All right, before we go, one of the reasons there's hate against Duke is because they played for so many years in the ACC against the University of Maryland.
Yes.
But speaking of Maryland, the D.C. Attorney General has accused three families of fraudulently enrolling children in city schools and is seeking more than $450,000 in unpaid fees and penalties. Apparently, one of the parents is a teacher at a D.C. high school, but it looks like the Attorney General is taking this matter quite seriously.
I think Attorney General Carl Racine is sending the message. This has been a classic case. Even when the district schools were notorious, working families have always found a way to send their children to the elementary schools because they have longer school days in the suburbs, and they try to do it without paying the $10,000 or now $14,000 a year tuition if you're an out-of-state person. People claim a grandmother's residence or uncle's space, or and it's just terrible. And so we had that issue at Duke Ellington where the city first overstated the number of people who were not residents, but there's still 70 plus or so who weren't residents. And it costs, if you're a parent and you have a child who wants to be in one school and he or she can't get there because other people are there and he turns out they're in the suburbs, they're from the suburbs. That's terrible. We should provide education for our students, and I'm glad Carl Racine is doing this.
That's all the time we have. Today's Politics Hour was produced by Mark Gunnery. This week we had a conversation on regional recycling that was so popular we continued the conversation after we went off the air. So go to kojoshow.org/blog. You can read all the answers to listener questions about what you can and cannot recycle. Coming up on Monday, we'll check in with Virginia activists on how Amazon's decision not to move half of its new headquarters to New York likely affects our region. And we'll talk with Montgomery County students who are organizing around gun control and school diversity. That all starts Monday at noon. Until then, thank you for listening. Any special plans this weekend?
It's President's Day weekend, Monday.
We get to work on President's Day.
We're going to pay attention to the current president for about 2 minutes.
Thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Nnamdi.
The Kojo Nnamdi Show is produced by Ruth Tam, Mark Gunnery, Julie Deppenbrock, and Margaret Barthel. Our managing producer is Angelisa Schrobstorff, and our senior producer is Mana Kashvi. Our intern is Sydney Grannon, and our engineer is Josephine Neonai. For past shows and more content, visit kojoshow.org.
Thanks for listening to The Kojo Nnamdi Show, and if you're already a member of WAMU 88.5, thank you for your support. If not, it's easy to give online at wamu.org. Just click the donate button, and thanks.